My life abruptly changed the night I let my best friend die in a gruesome phone freaking accident. The accident wasn't exactly my fault, but I kind of assumed that the whole thing would be blamed on me since I was there and I did nothing about it. So I panicked and I ran away. Looking back, I realized I could have handled it differently, but this is what I did instead. It began in the spring of 1990 in Edwardsville, Illinois. It was around 3 o'clock in the morning, and I sat up on a hill in a stranger's backyard, overlooking the back of the phone company building. My job was to keep a lookout as my partner in crime, Doug, rummaged around in a dumpster next to the building. We were behind the Illinois Bell building where they parked all of the phone company vans and stored a few old broken phone booths. It wasn't a fenced-in area, but it should have been. It's a wonder that any phone company would leave their dumpster wide open like they did. Phone freaks had been using the trash found in dumpsters for decades to acquire confidential information from the phone companies, yet very few bother locking their dumpsters, even today. Sometimes we would both climb into the dumpster, grab a few bags, and throw them in my car. Then we could take the loot home and sort through it for anything valuable. Doug liked to find passwords and phone numbers to modems so he could log in and attempt to gain access to Illinois Bell's computers. I was more just into the coolness of having secret phone company memos and other papers. Employee timesheets and records were boring, but they were useful when we wanted to call Illinois Bell and impersonate an employee there. Since we had their employee number or technician ID code, they had little reason to doubt our lies. Sometimes we would find huge printouts full of customers' voicemail passwords and phone numbers. The fun never ended with those. We could set up our own private mailboxes, we could completely take over someone else's box by changing their password and locking them out, or we could silently watch a box, checking a person's messages and never letting ourselves be known to them. Tonight we were doing things a little differently. Doug was sitting in the dumpster, sorting through papers and looking for anything good, while I sat under a tree, keeping an eye out for anyone who might interfere. Police would sometimes circle the parking lot, and nighttime employees would occasionally venture outside for a cigarette break, so it was good to know when to keep still and wait for them to leave. We kept in touch with a couple of Radio Shack walkie-talkies. I was tired and only half listening as I cranked up Love and Rockets on my Sony Walkman. "Alex, are you there?" I heard Doug ask through the walkie-talkie. "Yeah, I'm here," I said. "Are you almost done? I've been sitting here for almost an hour." "5 minutes tops. I found something here that you'll like," he replied. "Keep a lookout when I get out." "Gotcha," I said as I turned my Walkman back up and lay down in the grass, staring at the full moon and the clouds rushing past it. Once the song ended, I would sit back up and give Doug the all clear to climb out. Right about that time must have been when the garbage truck started rolling up. By the time I sat up, I was horrified to see it holding the dumpster in the air with its giant metal hooks, shaking the dumpster violently. I stood up and screamed for the driver to stop, but he didn't hear me. From my walkie-talkie, I could hear Doug yelling my name. As the garbage fell out of the dumpster and into the back of the truck, his voice turned into static. I threw down my Walkman and walkie-talkie and began rushing down the hill towards the truck, hoping I could stop it from crushing Doug alive. But by the time I jumped down onto the pavement, the garbage truck was already pulling away out into the street. "Wait, stop!" I screamed as loud as I could, but the driver didn't hear me. I ran down the street after the truck for several blocks, hoping to catch up to it and jump on, but I never made it. Any moron would know to immediately call the police. The police could have stopped the truck wherever it was and gotten to Doug. But how would that conversation go? "Yes, officer, me and my friend were working together to steal phone company secrets when out of nowhere this garbage truck shows up." The problem with getting the police involved was that Doug and I had caused so many problems in the past with our phone antics that the police were sure to piece it all together if they knew what we were up to. The police had been called because of our activity so many times over the past couple years, yet they'd never managed to figure out that a couple of innocent-looking, nerdy high school kids were responsible. In my panic, I was only thinking of myself and the trouble I would be in. I chose my own freedom over Doug's life. Doug was surely dead by now anyway. The crushing mechanism would have gone to work immediately after the trash was dumped, right? I had to face it. Doug was dead, and I was solely to blame for it. My whole future was completely screwed if I told anyone. And what if I didn't tell anyone? Would they ever find his body? Surely it would come back on me somehow. We were best friends, after all. How could I look anybody in the eye and tell them I didn't know where he was? So I ran. I ran back to the Illinois Bell building and up the hill to gather my backpack and my Walkman. I eyed my walkie-talkie, which was still laying on the ground. Should I even try? It was a 5-watt CB walkie-talkie, so if Doug was still alive, he would still be in range. "Doug," I said nervously into the walkie-talkie. "Are you there, Doug?" Nothing but static. I felt tears coming on as I began to realize the severity of the situation and I would never talk to Doug again. I threw the walkie-talkie against the side of a garage and watched it break into several pieces. A kitchen light turned on in the owner's home, so I quickly grabbed my backpack and headed towards my car, which was parked a few blocks away. If the police had stopped me on the way to the car, I wouldn't have been capable of lying to them. I confess everything. I tell them that we'd been stealing phone company trash and I'd watched my best friend get crushed to death, and I did nothing to prevent it. That we'd been tapping into various neighbors' phone lines for years to avoid long-distance charges to computer bulletin board systems. that our troublemaking had been featured in the paper so many times that Doug began keeping a scrapbook of the articles. But I wasn't stopped by anyone. I climbed into my car and began the drive towards my home in nearby Alton. A million thoughts and questions raced through my head during the 30-minute drive. Should I just go home and sleep as if nothing had happened? Should I go to school in the morning? How long would it take before authorities or parents came to me asking about Doug? What were the chances of his body even being found? Wouldn't they just dump all the trash into some big pit and nobody would ever see it? What would happen if I just confessed to everything? I'd end up in jail for sure. If not for Doug's death, they'd link our being at the phone company dumpster somehow with all the other things we'd done over the past several years. Breaking into voicemail boxes was nothing compared to all the chaos we'd caused since we started playing around with the phone company. There were too many newspaper articles to count that we'd been responsible for, and both of us stupidly kept clippings of every one of them. How was I supposed to get those articles out of Doug's room? Once they decided that Doug was really missing, they would find a notebook full of headlines reading things like, "Local resident hit with $50,000 phone bill," and "Payphone stuffing scammers at large," and my personal favorite, "Vandals opening up phone boxes, ringing up big charges." That was just the stuff that actually made the papers. There were countless incidents that had to have been investigated at some point. As I got within a few blocks of my home, I switched off the ignition and headlights of my 79 Dodge Colt, coasting down the street and through a few stop signs. This was to avoid waking my parents with my loud engine or the backfiring that sometimes occurred when I switched it off. I rolled to a stop in front of my house and headed for the basement window, which I'd left unlocked. My parents weren't too crazy about me leaving the house so late at night, so I'd found it easiest just to come and go quietly through the windows. By the time I'd gotten home, I decided that I would leave. Not only leave the town, but the state. I could write a short note for my parents telling them that I'd run away and everyone would just assume that Doug came with me. Doug absolutely hated his parents and fought with them constantly whenever I visited his house. In a way, I was saving his family a lot of grief, I reasoned. They'd be much better off thinking that Doug had run away with me rather than knowing he was rotting away at the bottom of some landfill. Running away was something I'd wanted to do for a long time. Not to run away from any problems, really, but just to get out and see some more of the world and have a little more freedom. Aside from a few out-of-state camping trips as a kid, I really hadn't seen much of the world, and I wanted to experience more. I wasn't too terribly close with my parents. I was doing horrible in school, and my best friend was now dead. So what was left to stay for? Earlier in the year, my girlfriend and I had been making plans to drive a U-Haul down to Texas and live. She was set on moving to an island called Galveston, which wasn't too far from Houston. I'm not sure if we would have really gone through with it or not, but we spent a lot of time planning it. Our year-long relationship had ended just a few months before, so maybe I could just make the trip there myself. I had no idea what Texas had to offer, but it had to at least be a little cooler than Alton, Illinois. So I figured I'd head south and see what happened. I wanted to travel as light as possible, but ended up making about 20 trips to my car, filling it with all kinds of items I thought might come in handy. I had hundreds of cassette tapes, and if I had to drive for a few days, then I may as well have music. I ended up bringing about half of my clothes, my laptop computer, with about 100 floppy disks, phone equipment, photos, a travel atlas, binders full of handwritten information and printouts on the phone companies that I'd collected over the years, and of course I gathered up all the newspaper articles related to our activities, just to make sure nobody else would find them. I jotted a quick note on the kitchen table that simply read, "Mom and Dad, moving south. Be in touch someday, Alex." I was careful to leave out the word "I," so they could take the note to mean Doug and I are moving south whenever Doug turned up missing. I wondered if they'd even notice the note sitting on the table covered with old mail, newspapers, and napkins. It could be days before they even noticed I was gone since I wasn't home that often. I stopped by a 24-hour grocery store to cash my paycheck from the movie theater I worked at. I didn't want my manager telling my parents or the authorities that I'd cashed my last check in Texas. After that, I was off. It was 5 a.m. and the sky was just beginning to light up. I had no idea how I was going to drive all day since I hadn't slept the night before, but somehow I managed to go on until the next evening. I spent most of the day driving and finally stopped at a rest stop somewhere in Mississippi, parking my car and almost immediately falling asleep in the front seat. I ended up arriving in Galveston, Texas early the next day. I'd slept off a good 4 hours or so at the rest stop and spent a few more hours just hanging out, eating, and relaxing before hitting the road again. I was dead tired when I got into Galveston, but still managed to drive myself around the island for most of the day, checking out the sights and learning where everything was. Spending my entire life in a small Midwestern community really made me appreciate a place like Galveston. Seeing all the beaches, surf shops, and palm trees was quite a culture shock for me. Around 8 p.m. that night, as it started to get dark, I pulled my car into a grocery store parking lot, reclined my seat, and went into a deep, dreamless sleep. I was worried that the police would notice me there and find out I was only 17 years old and send me back to Illinois. I couldn't afford to sleep in a motel, though. As I woke up later during the night, I noticed there were several other cars, vans, and RVs parked around the same quiet end of the parking lot. I later learned that they were also sleeping in their cars every night, so I decided to keep sleeping there until I secured some income. You'd think the story would continue in a strict chronological format, telling you exactly what happened after I covered up the death of my best friend. But no. Instead, I'm going to tell you about the Phone Losers of America, better known as the PLA, in a completely haphazard fashion. Those of you who know about the PLA will recognize the themes and stories in this book. Those of you who are new should prepare to enter the bizarre world of the PLA, where you'll find your outlook on life severely altered and you'll never look at a telephone the same way again. Just keep listening and it will all make sense to you eventually.